to visit him is his lawyer, and that's because she's fighting very, very hard to get those visitations. He has really awful conditions that have been documented by multiple organizations that show you that there is an organized and declared policy of the prison authorities to treat the 2,600 detainees that are inside these prisons poorly.
Well, Dr. Azra Ziada, you were in touch with Dr. Abu Safia every day for months. Your final thoughts, both on the film as well as on his condition now?
So I think the film really exposes and captures the process and the blueprint that Israel uses to attack and decommission hospitals. And I think the film is the most pertinent at this moment in time, because this blueprint is being used right now across Gaza. However, it's not really under the limelight, and it's not as exposed as it was when Dr. Abu Safia was in Kamal Adwan.
I want to thank you both for being with us, Dr. Azra Ziada. We thank you so much, London-based medical doctor, healthcare systems analyst, who's helped gather evidence of war crimes from Gaza and has been in touch with a network of doctors and healthcare workers in Gaza, including Dr. Abu Safia. And thank you so much to Amel Gutatfi, who is the director of this documentary, The Disappearance of Dr. Abu Safia, which is available online. We'll link to the whole documentary. That does it for our show. Democracy Now! Is produced with Mike Burke, Nicole Salazar. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
This is David Barsamian of Alternative Radio, and you're listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO's loud and proud. Become a member during our KBOO Out Loud Fall Membership Drive, taking place now through September 20th. Your contribution goes towards grassroots, independent, radically made community radio. Donate now by going to kboo.fm/give and help us reach our $45,000 goal. Thank you.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. The Finance Committee meets on the third Thursday of the month at 5:30 p.m. This month's meeting will be held online through a public video conference. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting can be found at our website at kboo.fm. Please visit our website to verify if a meeting is being held.
Support for KBOO comes from its members and from 988 Oregon, a public service helping those who are stressed, worried, or just feeling down when they call or text 988. Support is confidential, and call takers are real people in Oregon who speak with understanding and respect. More info at 988oregon.org.
Theater and democracy. What does one have to do with the other? Quite a bit, as it turns out. What began as a war on theater won't end there. Stay tuned. I'm Bert Cohn, and with your help, we are keeping democracy alive.
He's not breathing.
Can you get a pulse?
Barely.
We'll start with a bit of history. Quote, a culture war broke out in the 1930s over the place of arts and especially of theater in our democracy. That took place at a time much like our own of economic uncertainty, racial tensions, and rising nationalism and fascism, with new technologies transforming how entertainment and news were experienced. End of quote. Ring a bell, maybe? Well, this quote is from James Shapiro in his upcoming book, The Playbook, A Story of Theater, Democracy, and the Making of a Culture War. Fast forward about 90 years or so, and today there are so many targets of Trump's unprecedented war on history and our traditional diversity and celebration of culture. It's like a fire hose, just so powerful against so many targets, it's intentionally difficult to keep track. And as with all fascist dictatorships, it's essential to erase disquieting history and culture and replace them with a celebration of tales of strong, heroic, white, straight Christian men. Some of the targets are in the One Big Beautiful Bill Act, which appropriates $40 million for a National Garden of American Heroes, of course, as is designated by the Orange One himself. That vision includes the creation of 250 statues chosen for their political synchrony with Trump's values. His subjects will be what he decides are the greatest Americans to ever live. Then in the news lately, there's the Smithsonian Museum of African American History. That's been a target as well. Too much making slavery look bad, Trump insists. Imagine. Trump personally took over the Kennedy Center for the Performing Arts in D.C. One should try to, of course, to avoid too many comparisons, but it was Adolf Hitler who made war against what he called degenerate art. But the fact is, art is not just supposed to be soothing. Our history is our history, and patriotic Americans demand that actual history, not right-wing talking points, be taught in our schools. Though no doubt Trump is unfamiliar with the historic reality of feudalism, that is exactly what he intends to replace our republic with, the entire population of the country serving the whims of the white billionaires. There is no other culture permitted. Verboten. Author and Professor James Shapiro will soon conduct a webinar on the Federal Theater, Democracy, and the Making of a Culture War. And he writes in an essay that what began as a war on theater won't end there. And I am thinking that is true. As a rather different president, one who was deeply committed to how important it was to celebrate the diversity of American culture and arts, Franklin D. Roosevelt put federal dollars into projects that served to expand and increase average Americans' access to who we are as reflected through theater. Imagine, he created and funded such reinforcements of America's real strength through various programs under the umbrella of the Works Progress Administration. That included turning unemployed authors loose across America to create the American Guide series as part of the Federal Writers Project, which contained detailed histories. Histories and cultures of each of the then 48 states of the Union. In total, over 6,500 men and women were employed around the country as writers, collecting stories, interviews, and photographs. The American Guide series books paint a picture of American culture available to all, quite different from today's vision under the Orange One. They celebrate America's diversity. From 1937 to 1941, thousands of writers set out across the country to capture the culture, conducting fieldwork, interviewing citizens, and observing and recording folk traditions and local customs, things that the entire world loves about America, quite the opposite of the centralized power of a dictatorship. Perhaps more fun and entertaining was a little-known but wonderful piece of American history, which we'll discuss today, known as the Federal Theater Project, whose story was told in the Tim Robbins movie, The Cradle Will Rock. If you haven't seen it, I recommend it. Today, all such things are targeted for destruction by the current regime, as are American parks, many of which were created by Roosevelt's fifth cousin, Theodore. We love our parks. And when the Federal Theater Project was in business, it brought the theater to nearly one in four Americans, about 30 million Americans, often in those parks, many thousands who had never seen a play, celebrating our natural resources, creating genius of artists and actors was in the 1930s a shared American value. Wow, so hard to believe, but true. Trump's oligarchy is hard at work in an effort to wipe out all that. So let's be subversive here. What do you say? Let us shed light on when America was truly great. The largely forgotten Federal Theater Project. The Federal Theater Project brought live theater to thousands of ordinary Americans at no cost for the first time. At times controversial for its social commentary, the Federal Theater Project became a target of the right wing. Here today to share that glorious once and maybe future American reality is Harvey Smith, author of Berkeley and the New Deal. Harvey Smith has been researching this part of Berkeley's history for more than three decades. It's about the living legacy of the New Deal. Harvey Smith, thank you so much for being with us today on Keeping Democracy Alive. This is an important aspect of it. Tell us, please, about some of the plays performed for free by the Federal Theater Project. And please talk about two of them, The Cradle of Rock, which the movie was based on, and It Can't Happen Here. What was their power back then, and how might it relate to Trump 2.0?
Well, the Federal Theater Project was far-ranging. As you mentioned, it reached one in four Americans, and it performed in, I think it was 29 states in total. So it reached, like the New Deal, to almost every corner of the United States. And I think it's very representative of what FDR said about the New Deal as a whole. The test of our progress is not whether we add more to the abundance of those who have much, is whether we provide enough for those who have too little. Mm-hmm. And so that, you know, I think we generally think of that in economic terms, but it was also in terms of culture and recreation. You mentioned parks. So the federal government at that time, in a sense, democratized recreation, because most working people didn't have access to tennis courts or golf courses or swimming pools. And they built those all over the country. And likewise with culture, the what was known as Federal One, which was the music project, the art project, the writers project, and the theater project, and also historical records, again, brought those to people in every corner of the country. So you can go into a small post office and you can see a mural on the, you know, so people were exposed to this on a daily basis, whereas before it wasn't available. And so the theater project mounted all kinds of plays, you know, historical plays, that Shakespeare, but it also produced modern plays. And the ones that I think perhaps resonate a lot today are the group of plays called The Living Newspapers, which focused on topics that were of concern to people. So, for example, housing or public health, things like that. And you know, actually here in the Bay Area, we have a group called the San Francisco Mime Troupe that does a similar thing.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, it's sort of in a sense, a grandchild of the Living Newspapers of the 1930s. So these plays were again, productions were done all over the country. So one of the plays that you mentioned was It Can't Happen Here, which is particularly timely because it talks about a fictional era in the United States when somebody amasses power, is a populist leader, and turns the country into a fascist turns the position of the presidency into a fascist direction. So it was a warning. It was produced here locally, actually, somewhat recently. It was right before the first Trump term. It was put up in October and ran until nearly election day, right? But I guess it should have played many other places because the message obviously didn't get through that loudly. But now, you know, looking back, it's obviously it was a cautionary tale then, and particularly now, it seems like many aspects of that play are coming to reality.
The freedom that was involved. You talk about the Living Newspapers. I can only imagine. You know, it's sort of like an old version of Saturday Night Live, where they do weekly report, whatever it's called, except it was done in public where everybody could get it. This was in the early 1930s, before most people even had radios, never mind TV. And it brought the news and discussion of the news to the people. How incredibly subversive, I suppose, they would say these days. And you mentioned the post offices. Gosh, I remember when I was a kid. I hope it's still there. I haven't been to my old stomping grounds in a long time. But in the post office, there were some incredible murals that were created with federal dollars, created with by the Works Project Administration, reflecting the local region, showing the culture of the region. It was, they're big murals on the walls, and I hope they're still there. The idea of all this WPA stuff was, of course, to celebrate diversity and enable us all, yes, all of us actually, to feel a part and to be connected with our place and our culture and have a good time doing it. That was important, stuff Trump clearly hates. He doesn't want people to have fun. That's subversive. He wants to bury it as if it never existed. But FDR's was a positive vision, and there are people on the Democratic left today who also have a vision. Maybe we can actually make America great again. Could happen. And you mentioned it can't happen here. Who wrote that? And tell us again about The Cradle Will Rock. That was another popular, controversial play at the time.
Yeah, it was actually Sinclair Lewis wrote It Can't Happen Here. So there were many people that were of note at that time, and many kind of, it really launched their careers. So Arthur Miller was involved with the Federal Theater Project, Orson Welles, James Houseman, Burt Lancaster was actually, they had a circus division in the Federal Theater Project.
A circus division.
Part of it. Yes, because they, you know, at that time, circus was still alive and well, and there were still a lot of people that had played in vaudeville that were, actors were out of work. So that included vaudeville actors. So they did, the variety of the Federal Theater Project is pretty amazing. Hallie Flanagan, the director of the Federal Theater Project, after it was destroyed by the House Dies Committee, she wrote a book a year later. It's a history. It's a wonderful book. It basically catalogs everything that the theater project did, as well as tell this, the background story. But in the very last page of her book, she says, unlike the totalitarian states, democracy speaks in many voices. Its eloquence does not stem from a single political party, a single geographic area, a single uncontradicted voice. What she was attempting was what she had seen in Europe. She had seen national theaters in countries in Europe, and what you still see today, and or you may see in Canada the National Film Board. So federal governments can support culture, but I think, like she says, they don't expect it to be a single voice. And as she also points out, this is what the totalitarian state tries to do.
And it seems back then the federal government, the president and the White House, they were not afraid of the culture of the average people. Quite different. They actually celebrated it and, had average people involved in making this stuff and putting it on and totally accessible for free to everybody. 30 million, a quarter of the country was able to see these plays for free. If you just tuned in, Bert Cohen here. The show is Keeping Democracy Alive. Our guest today is Harvey Smith, author of Berkeley and the New Deal. And we're talking about democracy and the theater and how different it was. I mean, how making America great was celebrating, bringing arts and culture directly to the people for free, for everybody. Sit wealthy and not so wealthy people together, all being able to take part in celebrating our culture. One of the observations from your research, you note Berkeley's 1930s and early 40s New Deal structures and project left a lasting legacy of utilitarian and beautiful infrastructure. These public buildings, ooh, how radical, schools, parks, and artworks helped shape the city and the lives of its residents. The far-right faction of the Republican Party back in the 1930s targeted such things, these public buildings, schools, parks, and artworks, as they destroyed them in the in manifestation of them in the Federal Theater Project. Why is it hidden history, do you think? We've talked a bit about what the definition of the Federal Theater Project was, but why do you think it's so little known these days? I mean, even before Trump 2.0.
Yeah, well, I think those on the right would like to bury that history, not talk about it. And it's been chipped away at over the years. It started pretty much immediately after Roosevelt died. In Truman's administration, they went after labor law and started messing with with that. And then it's kind of gone on, but I think a lot of us don't realize, it's kind of like we're on a slow boil.
So
piece by piece, it's been taken apart. So if you look at the New Deal, what it represents is very comprehensive and equitable public policy. Mm-hmm. Of course, that's facilitated through big government and regulation. So primarily regulation of the corporate sector, but also other things that benefit us today, like federal deposit insurance for our bank accounts. Infrastructure, yes, primarily public development, and then programs that are brought, to Main Street, brought to every corner of the country. I spend a lot of time in that era. I study it. And sometimes it's kind of jarring when I think about what's happening now, because it's like the mirror opposite.
Yeah.
So rather than comprehensive and equitable policy, we get trickle-down economics, where if you enrich those at the top, somehow, magically, it's supposed to come down to the rest of us. And what we're witnessing now is, obviously defunding of big government, tax cuts, for the wealthy, deregulation, an emphasis on private development, and privatization of the public sector. So those parks that you talked about, there are plans to strip away part of them and give them up to a private industry. So it's sort of the mere opposite, and little by little, we've gotten us to the point where we've taken the New Deal for granted. We've sort of taken Social Security for granted. We've taken the federal deposit insurance for granted, and other aspects. But we see a really fast slide in the direction of removing almost all of the New Deal.
Boy, don't give him any ideas, mentioning the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation. I can imagine the orange one, rubbing his hands together. Oh boy, that may cost the government money. So let's take that away and figure, people take their chance on investments. That's the way it should be, right? So much good came from that. And certainly all dictators throughout history focus on erasing history and replacing it with myths that reinforce their fascist vision. In what ways did the Federal Theater Project then and artistic freedom today threaten the right-wing oligarchic powers? Why is government working to enhance the common good such a threat to them? What do you think, Narvi?
Well, because it's a threat to their power. When Hallie Flanagan was trying to look at what happened, with the Federal Theater Project, she did fight back against the Dyes Committee, but she knew that they were throwing a lot of things at her that they wouldn't allow her to respond to. That stuff that they made up, that seems to be a very live tactic today. One of the things pointed out that you mentioned, James Shapiro's relatively new book came out last year, but a book that came out several years ago, 2008, is a book by Susan Quinn called Furious Improvisation. And when she tried to explain what was really going on, you know, with the attack in the Federal Theater Project. And she states briefly that they were afraid of the Federal Theater because it was educating the people of its vast new audience to know more about government and politics and such vital issues of the day as housing, power, agriculture, and labor. They were afraid, and rightly so, of thinking people.
Afraid of thinking people. Yeah, yes. Ignorance is celebrated today.
That's what Hallie Flanagan wrote in the New York Times during the day when the Federal Theater was under attack. So I think that's the issue. You know, if we start to think and connect the dots, you know, we may realize that trickle-down economics doesn't really work for us, you know?
Oh, I do know. As Rocky famously said to Bullwinkle, that trick never works. When Bullwinkle, well, anyway, it had to be there, I suppose. Well, I'm a fan of the Rocky and Bullwinkle theater. Wasn't there, my memory is not always perfect. Sometimes it's correct. There was something in New York, I think, in the early 1960s, the Living Theater, that was also shook things up a little bit. Maybe that was in, you know, the Village or something like that. What, does that ring a bell to you, Harvey?
Oh, yeah. I actually had a brush with them. And in Morocco, of all places, where they were, I think, vacationing. But that's another story. But yeah, they were a provocative theater, and they were one of many. I mean, a theater, we could all enjoy Shakespeare and the classics, and it's something we're familiar with. Maybe we've seen a Shakespeare play three or four times, but we also need theater that makes us think, that it deals with contemporary issues. And, you know, art does do that. You know, art does make us think. If it's just something that is window dressing, we quickly get bored, I think. So the Living Theater was a group like that that was avant-garde at that time. Whether they play well today, I'm not sure.
Right.
But I know that, you know, our local theater group, the San Francisco Mime Troupe, every year puts on free plays in the parks, and they address contemporary issues. And certainly the play this year looked at you know, what's going on right now, which is, you know, it's obviously frightening. We hear about it every day, and you know, people in mass, gathering people up on the streets. It does resonate with "It Can't Happen Here," believe me.
Wow. I'm sure. And I think about theater. Once I was with the Abraham Lincoln Brigade Board of Governors meeting in New York. I try to avoid the big city, but I had nothing to do there, so I went to see a play. It was a good play, The Book of Mormon, but man, it was expensive. And, you know, Trump taking over the Kennedy Center for the Performing Arts, you know, I'm sure, I can't help but think that they want to keep it super expensive. I mean, I went to that play many years ago, and just for one ticket, it was like $200. It's like, what? But that's, you know, keeping culture just as a sole ownership of the ultra rich. Boy, they want to do that, and I don't know, make everybody else desperate and feel helpless. And, you know, if a little knowledge is a dangerous thing, and of course they know that, they don't want people to be knowledgeable, and there was so much to that, and this celebration of diversity and bringing diversity to the people. We talked about the Kennedy Center. They might try to rename it, and as noted in Shapiro's book on the topic, the Federal Theater Project brought over 1,000 productions to 29 of the then 48 states, being seen by 30 million are about a quarter of the entire U.S. population. Now it's about a tenth. Too many people. Anyway, the Federal Theater Project brought entertainment to work camps, where hiking trails still in use today were created. If you've ever been on any of those trails in those beautiful national parks, thank the CCC and the Times of Roosevelt, the New Deal. It brought children's plays on touring trucks to kids in crowded cities. It brought free theater to asylums, orphanages, hospitals, prisons, and veterans' homes. That's from Shapiro's book. Fast forward to Trump 2.0. He's taken over the Kennedy Center for the Performing Arts and seeks to whitewash history in the Smithsonian to his liking. Slavery. Can't say slavery's too bad. No, you can't say that. Reserving theater and the arts for the elite. Talk about the essential egalitarian nature of the Federal Theater Project audiences and why that might today threaten the Trumpsters, the egalitarian nature of the Federal Theater Project.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think this administration is anything but egalitarian. You know, helping the rich more, they really don't need it. You know, the New Deal did have a broader vision. FDR in 1944, his State of the Union address, which has come to be called the Economic Bill of Rights or Second Bill of Rights speech, talks about the fact that we all have or should have inherent rights to employment, housing, education, and health care. And those concepts were later, after the end of World War II, when the UN was founded, those concepts were incorporated into the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. And in many places, you know, throughout the world, they people believe that that is true. But that belief didn't really take root here, and we've seen advances in each of those areas fall by the wayside. So, you know, we could go on and on about employment and, you know, people working two or three jobs or just trying to get a job at this point. Housing is, you know, one of the top issues right now. It's out of the reach of many, many people. Education. You know, we used to have public education. I'm a product of the University of California when education was truly public. And now at our public universities, students are paying thousands of dollars in tuition. That's something else that's been taken from us. And we never quite got health care. I'm convinced that if FDR would have lived that final term, we would have had a national health program. But, you know, we made great strides, you know, during the New Deal and really up until 1980. That was with the election of Ronald Reagan. That was the major turning point where we're now going in this direction of what some people call neoliberal austerity. You know, benefit those at the top, and the rest of us have got to somehow fend for ourselves. And so I think some of the plays of the Federal Theater Project dealt with those basic issues. You mentioned Cradle Will Rock. I think that's a great example, and it's very accessible to the film. You can see the film by Tim Robbins, which was a labor of love. I don't know how many films get a companion book to go along with them, because I think Robbins realized that the great debt that we owe to what the Federal Theater Project did, but also to you know, resurrect the memory of it, because maybe again at some point we can get to a point where there is support for theater, you know, throughout the country. But the film is wonderful. It does follow the history of the Federal Theater Project. There was some parts that are fictionalized. The guy the Bill Murray character. And the reason he put Bill Murray in, he says, is because he wanted to talk about those vaudeville actors that were involved in the project, and that was the Bill Murray character. But at any rate, it does trace the history of that play, Cradle Will Rock, and then the whole fiasco at the Dyes Committee hearings and manipulation of what was the true purpose and history of the Federal Theater Project.
This is such fascinating stuff. I hope you, dear listener, are enjoying it. I sure am. And, you know, it's like what could be, as you say, what could have been, you know, the Economic Bill of Rights from 1944 and then the UN Declaration of Human Rights. It amazes me how the Democrats, the official Democratic Party, the Democratic National Committee, the corporate Clintonites, I like to call them. I wish they weren't. You know, they just want to be, well, we're not Trump, so vote for us. You know, if people, I think, were exposed to the ideas of the Economic Bill of Rights, the Declaration of Human Rights, I think that would be really popular. But no, I don't know what it is. They don't want to alienate their big givers, their big, you know, billionaire givers. It appalls me that the possibilities are there. We can learn from history. Was that ever radical, huh? Learning from history. We could do that and make America great again. What a concept. If you just tuned in, I'm Bert Cohen, and the show we're doing is Keeping Democracy Alive. Our guest today is Harvey Smith, who is author of Berkeley and the New Deal. He's been researching this part of Berkeley's history for more than three decades, and we're talking about a living legacy of the New Deal. We've briefly touched on what happened to it. It's a kind of ugly end, the Federal Theater Project, when it was shut down by the House Un-American Activities Committee, which in itself, I think, was pretty darn un-American. Anyway, a series of fact-based plays exploring subjects as urgent as war, flood control, oh boy, is that ever prescient, food and drugs and racism in America. All these plays were in development at the time it was shut down. And Shapiro, in his book, says, for the health of democracy and theater, twin-born in ancient Greece. That's worth repeating, I think. The health of democracy and theater, twin-born in ancient Greece, have always been mutually dependent. What do you think he means by that? What is the important nexus between democracy and theater?
Well, I think you could even expand it. It's the arts in general. When actors perform, they're talking about, you know, sometimes very deep issues. They're talking about human emotions. They're talking about history. They're bringing before people things that resonate, you know, with an audience. And I think that any art, should attempt to do that, you know, should attempt to make us feel, make us think, and make us act. And I think that's a part of it also. And I think that's the part that does scare those that just want to control us, control of the economy. We all participate in this economy. We all make this country the richest country in human history. And I think the idea of the New Deal was that we should all share in that. The reason that I think the history has to be revised is that for a period of time, we did have something that really moved in that direction, that moved towards those human rights for all of us. And now, you know, we're moving in a very, you know, essentially the opposite direction. Yeah. But the New Deal illustrates that these ideas, are not something that is just a fiction. It's not utopian. We actually had these things, and they've been many of them taken away from us. And the right seems to be going for more. So I think it's important lessons that we get from the New Deal, that this is really the direction we should be going. And when politicians, you were mentioning the official Democratic Party, when those politicians that do talk about these essential issues, they're popular. They get votes because it resonates with people. And the fact that if the Democratic Party cannot come around, that certainly they don't seem to be in Congress, but we do see governors today that are standing up. So
yes,
maybe that the governors are going to be the leadership at this point, mm-hmm. and hopefully drag on the national leadership.
And as I've heard it said so many times, that politics really is so much theater. It really is theater. And, you know, what grabs the attention? I mean, Trump, let's face it, he's really good at grabbing and holding the attention. He just can't stand it when he's not the lead story and captures everything. But these ideas do resonate. And if the Democrats could just talk about them, it amazes me that why they don't. They do resonate. We have a few people you talk about theater. I saw J.B. Pritzker, governor of Illinois. Boy, he is one strong character, shall we say, if you think about theater. He grabs and holds. And there are a few other governors, obviously, the governor of your state out there on the left coast. And hopefully could be the mayor of New York, Mondani. He's a very impressive guy. And the fact you know and I know, 84-year-old Bernie Sanders goes out there in red states and draws huge crowds. Democrats, wake the heck up. I don't understand this. One of my favorite quotes people get tired of, no doubt, is that one thing I've learned from history is that we never learn from history. But we could. There's so much to learn that was popular. The Federal Theater Project was popular. Let's get to what the heck happened to it. How and why did the Federal Theater Project end? Talk about this DIES committee and what were they up to? And talk about that, please.
Well, this was the first House Un-American Activities Committee. And initially it was formed to actually go after investigate fascists and those who were truly un-American, but it conveniently quickly turned its gaze over to programs that the Republicans at that time didn't like, and so the Federal Theater Project was an easy target because again they did many, many plays. A few of them, though, did really get people's attention and again, were easy targets. So they went after the Federal Theater Project. They also went after the Writers Project, not quite as intensely as with the Federal Theater. So, with the accusation that there were communists in the project, and at that time there were, there were some people, but there were people of all political stripes. And they were not doing illegal activity, but they definitely had political ideas, right?
Whoa.
And we sometimes talk about the marketplace of ideas, or the forum of ideas. And why not? Why not debate ideas? But again, they were an easy target, so they were brought up before the committee. And you see this in the film. Cradle Will Rock. Hallie Flanagan definitely prepared a great defense, but she was not allowed to actually give her full defense. They brought up witnesses that had, with trumped up charges, and Martin Dyes, like Trump, loved the headlines. They got the headlines. And the project became too much of a risky venture for the administration. So it was discontinued. It had, several years of great work, under its belt. We have that history, so we can look back on it. But unfortunately, it was defunded. And then the Federal Writers Project met a similar fate. But many states recognized the value of the project because it one of its major efforts was the American Guide series, which were guidebooks.
Yes.
But beyond kind of a AAA guide, it was a guidebook that that had history, that focused on literature. It was full of artwork and photographs, and people like John Steinbeck lauded the American Guide series when he did his journey Travels with Charlie. Became book Travels with Charlie. He said, I wish I could have taken all the guidebooks with me, but I didn't have that much room in the pickup truck. So they've been lauded over the years. They're still being published or republished. Every state got a guidebook, but then many cities also got their own guidebook. Berkeley, on its 75th anniversary, got a guidebook. And so the Writers Project did lots of incredible research. Haven't even been published. There's still lots of good material that are in the archives produced by the Federal Writers Project.
Just such great stuff, and turning people loose and celebrating. And one thing about the Federal Theater Project and the Writers Project and the guidebooks, especially the American guidebooks, is it wasn't just how to get from point A to point B and what the best restaurants to eat at were. They didn't even have Howard Johnson's back then, they showed the culture. You know, they dug into the culture, what a town or a state is. With, you know, there's wealthy people and there's not so wealthy people, but they didn't hide any of it. They showed it and celebrated it. Just amazing. And being able to show the full measure of what we are as Americans, it's so different from what we have now, but the possibilities are still there. You've probably heard of this far-right group calling itself Moms for Liberty. Their chosen task is to force the schools and school boards to censor books and arts and theater education in our public schools. Of course, they want to themselves police what might offend the right wing's sensibilities. Talk about the importance of theater in our public schools, please.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, this is where people get their start, and in theater or in a lot of areas. And what we've done by narrowing the curriculum just narrows our horizons or the horizons of people coming up today. So if we eliminate art programs, music programs, theater programs, and even shop programs, it's interesting because now with the economy moving the way it is, there's a renewed interest in the industrial arts, and it's something that I grew up with, and I could tell you why it was a value to me, even though I was more of an academic student. But those industrial arts classes were kind of essential. So it's we're fully capable in this country of providing a really wide ranging education to people.
Yes.
But again, for so-called budgetary reasons, we tend to cut back. And it's ridiculous. We're the richest country in human history. California, for example, is the world's fourth largest economy. So if you look at our issue of homelessness, we shouldn't have one homeless person here in this state. But it's about allocation of resources. It's about how we collect taxes these days, and our system. If you look at essential rights, and enabling people to have a fuller life, we're getting shortchanged, and if you think about the talents that could be cultivated by full educational programs. Getting back to the theater project, they focused on the range of theater, but they also got into areas that were not so popular then. They had mixed cast, they had black and white cast.
Oh, horrors.
They developed a Negro theater. at that time, Negro theater.
Right.
And then they also had what they called foreign language drama. So they did plays in French, German, Italian, Spanish, Yiddish, you know, because there were people out there where this was, you know, their primary languages. And there was a history of plays in those languages. So why not, you know, why not full, you know, explore the full variety of what's available, you know, in the literature of plays. Yes. So, you know, and another, I think a reason, again, that a congressperson from Texas would attack the project was the fact that it did integrate the theater. It did put on the stage black actors, and there were incredible productions. I mean, there was one a production of Macbeth that became nicknamed the Voodoo Macbeth because it took place in Haiti, but it was directed by Orson Welles with an all-black cast. Mm. And it was quite the rage in Harlem and other places. So, again, it what theater can do is create a richness of culture and, you know, point to all the talents that we have available in this country rather than just promoting a few areas.
The possibilities are just amazing, and it's so frustrating how far we've moved away from that and what those in power are so deathly afraid of. Bert Cohen here. The show is Keeping Democracy Alive. If you just tuned in, and our guest today is Harvey Smith. We're talking about the Federal Theater Project, the Federal Writers Project, the possibilities that there were in the 1930s and are still there today. And certainly the 1930s were a unique time in American history. Back then, you know, the only political group to be talking about ending segregation and equal rights for all was the Communist Party. It wasn't such a big deal. This was way before Stalin came into power and messed it up and disguised fascism as communism. It wasn't. But anyway, it was a unique time in history. There was a vibrant left and a crusading far right at the same time. There was open support for the promise of social programs like Medicare. In fact, parenthetically, people today have said, oh, keep government out of my Medicare. Mm-hmm. There was still there was a lot of support for socialism, but a powerful segment openly supporting the Nazis. Shapiro writes, in that respect, it anticipated our current divide, the dividing legacy of this culture, war, as how these strategies coalesced into a right-wing playbook widely used today for securing power and challenging progressive initiatives. And you say, Harvey, the times again may call for comprehensive public policy that reaches Main Street. Talk about that, please, in terms of what you and I might call making America actually great again.
Well, it's the whole thrust of the New Deal, bringing, you know, the programs and the power of the federal government to benefit people at the level of Main Street. The idea behind my book, when I researched it, is I realized that there were about 100 cities the size of Berkeley at that time throughout the country. And what I wanted to do was write a book that represented that, you know, looked at Berkeley as a microcosm of what was happening more broadly. And because the New Deal reached every corner of the country, it was urban, it was rural, it brought, you know, electricity to places in rural areas that never had it before. And so the idea, and, you know, it wasn't perfect. It did, you know, we could criticize the New Deal, but broadly the thrust was trying to help the average person. And now, again, we've turned that on its head where we, you know, we try to do whatever we can for those, the uber wealthy, and somehow that they're supposed to help the rest of us. It's never worked that way.
No.
It didn't work.
It never worked.
When we were originally, originally talking about trickle-down economics under Ronald Reagan, and it's still not working today. So, you know, when I look around my town, and you know, people here, sometimes I get this reaction to my book. They'll say, well, yeah, I know all those places in their book, but I didn't know they were all connected to the New Deal, or they were built by the New Deal. And that's the issue. That's the hidden part of the history. And we don't recognize, you know, the massive work that was done. And actually, you know, I worked on a project, and it's a book to come out, on how the New Deal helped win World War II. Because in many respects, one of the areas I focused on was airports. Well, aviation in this country in the 30s was really way behind Europe. Our airports were primitive. Our communication systems were primitive. And the New Deal supported the building of airports and supported the, at that time, budding airline industry. And the result was that by the time World War II came around, the U.S. was prepared. And that's represented in other areas. If you look at the Civilian Conservation Corps, that took very, in many cases, very poor, not very healthy young men and put them to work doing useful work throughout the country. We had a corps of men that was, you know, ready when we needed them for another project. So we could go on and on about how the New Deal really helped the country, how we're still relying on that infrastructure today, and how it benefited people that at every level. So it's I think very, very important lessons for all of us. And you know, at the end of her book, Hallie Flanagan, she closes it, and I think it's sort of indicative. The last couple of sentences in the book read, "The 10,000 anonymous men and women, the et ceteras and the not so force, did the work. The nobodies who were everybody, the somebodies who believed it. Their dreams and deeds were not the end. They were the beginning of a people's theater in a country whose greatest plays are still to come." So even after having been, you know, beat up thoroughly by the by Martin Dies, Hallie Flanagan still had hope for the future. And I think that's what the New Deal should give us, is we've been there, we've done it before, we could do it again. You know, for example, we don't have to have a housing crisis. We really made major strides in beating back the housing crisis. And again, we have to look beyond, I think, our borders, because if you go to Europe, education is, for the most part, still public. There are massive programs to public programs for housing. And that world of the New Deal does exist in other places. It just may not exist like it did here.
And you just sparked something in me. I mean, the Democrats, I'm a Democrat, left-leaning Democrat for sure. And the party has been like, how do we get young men back on our side? And nobody's come up with anything. But just talking with you, I realized, hey, the 1930s, the New Deal did it. They involved young men. Young men feel so left out, so isolated these days. If there were something like the New Deal, or if the Democrats proposed it, you know, creating interesting, hardworking jobs for young men, oh, God, I think that would help bring the party, you know, bring young men back into the party. That's been a real problem. And yeah, we'll see if any Democrats dare to talk about that. One last thing. It's been called an isolation crisis these days. People all alone with their computers, just sitting there with your computer. No community contact. Does the example of the Federal Theater Project offer a way to address this? And if so, how?
Why, I think absolutely. I mean, in order to see a play, you have to go to where the play's being put up, and you're there with other people. And you I think the energy that's produced by a good production is infectious. You know, it affects the audience. People walk out of the theater, or if it's a play that's being performed in a park after the play, you sense that people have gone through an experience together. I think that's the key thing, you know. And so if again, if we can recharge those ideas that we had back then and bring them to people, I think it certainly resonates. And you mentioned the young people, that it affected young people at every level, but also the people that came to Washington and put together the Federal Theater Project, the Writers Project, who wrote the Social Security Act under Francis Perkins. These were people that were young and idealistic, and they were given rein to explore, you know, their imagination and explore possibility, and they did that in a great way. So I think looking at that history, it's got to my mind, inspire anybody. Again, it's not focused on one thing or one little area, but it's very broad, and it can sustain us all.
It can. Maybe we can make America actually great again. Hey, Harvey, yes. How can people read more of your stuff? Is there something you can point to on the internet?
Well, the thing I would point to is the organization I work with, the Living New Deal, which has a great website. The core of it is a interactive map that is attempting to map all of the New Deal. So all the artwork, all the buildings, all the parks. And so that's very instructive. You can go to your own local area, and if you don't see something that you know was New Deal, then you can submit it. It's interactive. Also, it has a newsletter. So upcoming webinar that is coming up on the Federal Theater Project, it's actually, I think, October 21st. You can find information about that there and other events happening throughout the country. So New Deal related events, and then art showings, things like that. Are there on the website. So I would suggest people go there. I actually have an article in the newsletter on public housing, in the most recent one.
So the website is livingnewdeal.org or com or something?
Yeah, livingnewdeal.org.
Excellent. This has been very entertaining and daring.